Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Queen's Law Pro Bono Radio. My name is Maeve McNaughton and I will be your host this week. I'm a 1L student here at the Queen's University Faculty of Law and have the privilege of working with the Queen's Chapter of Pro Bono Students Canada to discuss new and emerging legal topics in an accessible format. This week, we'll be looking at new and emerging legal methods of environmental protection, focusing on environmental personhood and ecocide. It's no secret that climate change is one of, if not the most serious and imminent threat to society. I won't relay the terrifying statistics that I'm sure we all know, but long story short, the Earth and its environment is in trouble. Unfortunately, rather than being able to rely on the cooperation and understanding of fellow humans, it's looking like the imposition of legal liability may be necessary to forcefully stop the destruction of the environment that we depend on. The only common law way to protect, say, a stream from destruction has been to establish that another human has had their property rights infringed upon. This human-centric approach fails to recognize the symbiotic relationship of humans and nature. Harming a natural entity, even if not directly infringing upon a human's legal rights, inevitably will cause harm, not only to one human, but many. As French philosopher Bruno Latour points out, society has created a false boundary between nature and culture. We look at global warming and think of it as separated into people, politics, and science, when really it's a hybrid of everything, of one thing. Humans themselves are nature, and vice versa. In 2007, the Government of Canada adopted the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, also known as UNDRIP. The declaration, aimed at affirming the inherent right of Indigenous people around the world, provides several rights regarding land, natural resources, and environmental protection. Some of these include Article 25, which states that Indigenous peoples have the right to maintain and strengthen their distinctive spiritual relationship with their traditionally owned or otherwise occupied and used lands, territories, waters and coastal seas and other resources, and to uphold their responsibilities to future generations in this regard. There's also Article 26, which states, 1. Indigenous peoples have the right to lands, territories, and resources which they have traditionally owned, occupied, or otherwise used or acquired. 2. Indigenous peoples have the right to own, use, develop, and control the lands, territories, and resources that they possess by reason of traditional ownership or other traditional occupation or use, as well as those which they have otherwise acquired. And 3, states shall give legal recognition and protection to these lands, territories, and resources. Such recognition shall be conducted with due respect to the customs, traditions, and land tenure systems of the Indigenous peoples concerned. Finally of note is Article 29, which states that Indigenous peoples have the right to the conservation and protection of the environment and the productive capacity of their lands or territories and resources. States shall establish and implement assistance programs for Indigenous peoples for such conservation and protection without discrimination. UNDRIP was the basis of a 2023 resolution passed by the Assembly of First Nations of Quebec-Labrador, composed of the chiefs of the 43 First Nations. The resolution, which was made in 2021, recognizes legal personhood for the St. Lawrence River system and affirms the attention of the AFNQL to be part of legal decisions impacting the river. The resolution refers to the rights of Indigenous people as laid out in the UNDRIP and asserts that the St. Lawrence River system falls under the territories subject to the declaration as it has been vital to their culture and economy for centuries. The resolution is focused on the threats being faced by the river and those who depend on it, including ecosystems and endangered species. The AFNQL assert themselves as legal guardians of the St. Lawrence River system and recognize it as having legal personhood. This resolution is a first step towards obtaining legal personhood for the St. Lawrence River, as it signifies a willingness by Indigenous leaders to be active in the legal processes required to protect the river. So, what is legal personhood, and how can a non-person have it? As put by Gwendolyn Gordon in her paper on the topic, environmental personhood is, quote, the nascent notion of designating parts of nature as legal persons entitled to independent regard and consideration. This concept of legal personhood, as said by John Dewey, quote, signifies what the law makes it signify. What it really means changes based on jurisdiction, context, etc. In the context of environmental personhood, it essentially allows a piece of nature to hold, defend, and owe rights just like a person. The idea of extending legal personhood to non-persons is not unique to environmental structures. Legal personhood has been extended to corporations since the Middle Ages, allowing a non-human entity to sue, be sued, enter contracts, and more. The Magpie River in the Côte Nord region of Quebec, known to the Innu First Nation as Matehekoshipu, is the first natural feature to gain legal personhood in Canada. The river, which has been a sacred part of Innu culture for centuries, has faced the looming threat of dams for hydroelectricity. Such dams would disrupt the natural flow of the river, consequently threatening the fragile ecosystems that depend upon this consistent flow for survival. In response, the Innu Council and Mangani Regional County Municipality worked together to give the river legal personhood in 2021. This monumental moment in Canadian environmental protection gave the river 9 rights. The right to flow, the right to respect for its cycles, the right for its natural evolution to be protected and preserved, the right to maintain its natural biodiversity, the right to fulfill its essential functions within its ecosystem, the right to maintain its integrity, the right to be safe from pollution, the right to regenerate and be restored, and finally, the right to sue. One major issue in protecting the environment via legal personhood that you may have already noticed is that it requires legal guardians to sue on behalf of the structure in question, as well as someone to invest time and money in pursuing litigation on behalf of it. In Ecuador, for example, the Global Alliance for the Rights of Nature was successful in a lawsuit against a construction company to protect a river. When the company failed to follow through with the court ruling, however, the alliance had no money left to take them back to court. In the sphere of international law, discussion is turning towards internationally criminalizing ecocide, defined by the Independent Expert Panel for the Legal Definition of Ecocide as, quote, unlawful or wanton acts committed with the knowledge that there is a substantial likelihood of severe and either widespread or long-term damage to the environment being caused by those acts. Several proponents of criminalizing ecocide would like to see ecocide recognized as the 5th international crime to go along with the current 4 of genocide, crimes against humanity, war crimes, and the crime of aggression. If adopted by the state's parties, ecocide would become the first international criminal law to target a wrong that does not require direct and severe harm to humans. Just like legal personhood, however, there are of course barriers to internationally criminalizing ecocide, among them being determining the fault requirement. Specific intent is not appropriate because most perpetrators do not commit ecocide with the intent of harming the environment. Lower fault requirements, such as strict liability or criminal negligence, on the other hand, may not be sufficient to justify the severity of international criminalization. Some have pointed out another flaw in that the International Criminal Court may not be the most efficient forum for prosecuting ecocide. The already overwhelmed ICC would not have the capacity to hear a significant number of cases regarding ecocide. Professor Daryl Robinson, in his article on The Puzzles and Possibilities of Ecocide, suggests an alternative. A widely accepted convention, which is accepted by parties and incorporated into individual domestic law. Although no such convention exists yet, several countries have taken matters into their own hands and are beginning to criminalize ecocide nationally, the most recent of these being Belgium, which approved a penal code recognizing the crime of ecocide in February of 2024. Despite growing support, Canada has not yet recognized ecocide in its criminal code. Between the emerging use of environmental personhood and the possible future recognition of the crime of ecocide on both a national and international scale, there really is no foolproof legal method to protect the environment. Current and proposed solutions all have their downfalls. The conversation really comes down to which is the best method rather than which one is perfect. Here to discuss that with me today is Professor Daryl Robinson. Professor Robinson is a professor at the Queen's University Faculty of Law, specializing for over 25 years in international criminal justice. He earned a Minister's Citation and Minister's Award for Foreign Policy Excellence for his role in the negotiation of the Rome Statute and Canada's Crimes Against Humanity Act. Professor Robinson has dozens of publications on international criminal law. More recently, he's been involved in research regarding internationally criminalizing ecocide as part of the UCLA Promise Institute project, a project to consider the use of international criminal law in protecting the environment. Thank you so much for coming on here today to talk to me about ecocide. It's exciting to have somebody with so much experience firsthand in the development of ecocide in Canada and internationally.
Happy to be here.
So I will just jump right into the questions. So the first one is, branding someone as a criminal requires a grave standard of wrongdoing, especially for international crimes. If adopted, ecocide would be the first international crime that does not require serious and direct harm to human beings. So could you speak a bit to why you do or don't believe that environmental harm meets the standard?
I think it definitely does meet the standard. In criminal law, we split things up into two kinds of crimes: regulatory offenses, which are considered minor, mostly just fines, and then criminal law, which we use for the most serious things where we really want to condemn them. Environmental harm has long been considered just regulatory. So businesses will often deliberately do it and just absorb any fines as the cost of doing business. So we're not really taking environmental harm seriously enough. The idea of ecocide, it's going to be a crime that just deals with the absolute worst environmental harm, like things that cause widespread, long-term, severe damage. And I think that totally belongs in criminal law and even in international criminal law, because these are the kinds of harms that are going to hurt like entire communities of people. It jeopardizes the health of present generations of humans and future generations of human and then other animals. So I think that's the signal, is causing this kind of harm indirectly to the environment belongs at the very top of the things that we condemn as criminal.
So you also mentioned in your previous work on ecocide that amending the ICC statute to add ecocide might not be the best way to establish a crime of ecocide. Could you expand a bit on why that is and how domestic courts may be a preferable forum?
Right. I'm all in favor of every way to make ecocide happen. But yeah, a lot of people are focused on adding it to the International Criminal Court statute. And I'm fine with that if and when it can be done. But there's a bunch of hurdles to do that. Like you have to get a supermajority of the ICC states parties to agree to it. And even if you succeed, the International Criminal Court is just one court. It's one forum that's already pretty overloaded with the cases that it has. So that's why I personally, I like both ways, but I favor trying to get it passed into legislation in as many countries as we can. And it's working. Parliaments are thinking about ecocide and they're starting to adopt crimes. There's this wave of them. And so my vision is, if we can get 80 countries to adopt this law, then we have all the courts of 80 different countries working away on ecocide. And then someday, yeah, of course, we'll add it to the International Criminal Court too. But my thinking is national level first and then the international.
I know this isn't really your area of specialty, but we did touch a little bit earlier on legal personhood being granted to environmental structures. I just wanted to get your thoughts on, like, do you think criminalizing ecocide in Canada is preferable to granting legal personhood to environmental structures? As in, do you think that the criminal courts are the best way to handle this rather than civil courts? And if so, why?
I think my answer is, let's do both. The environmental crisis we're facing, it's really a complicated picture, and let's use every tool we have. I think criminal law and civil law and all kinds of other mechanisms, they can go together. They can be complementary. They can do different things. A lot of really cool things are happening with legal personhood of nature in Canada and other countries. And you know, there's an overlap between that and ecocide. To put two, I don't remember if you've already covered these two words, but anthropocentric and ecocentric. Anthropocentric means we're focusing on humans and human interests. Ecocentric means protecting nature as an end in itself. So both these movements, the legal personhood of nature and ecocide, they have that in common. They're both ecocentric. So ecocide says, let's protect nature as an end in itself. I guess I should also say, I mean, I turn to criminal law because I'm a criminal law person, but I think that criminal law is only a very, very small piece of this puzzle. Criminal law can express the values of a society. And I guess that's the message I want to give, is that massive environmental harm, it's not just a regulatory offense the way we've been considering it. So I like the idea of criminal law to signal that we condemn this as one of the most serious harms that anybody can do. And so my vision one day is a board of directors standing nervously around the table saying, well, is this ecocide, and backing off. So that's the role that criminal law can play, is signaling this is not just regulatory, this is not business as usual, it's actually a really bad thing. But criminal law will be one small little piece of the puzzle, and there will be civil law, environmental law, and then all kinds of non-law things too. Like, we have to change our cultures, technology, society. There's all kinds of changes we have to do.
Okay, and then the last question is a bit of a two-parter. So first of all, is a crime of ecocide, in your opinion, just an aspiration, or is it likely to actually become a reality in the near future?
Yeah, great. Yeah. It is moving surprisingly quickly. When I talk to government officials, at first they would smirk a little because ecocide is, they consider it kind of pie in the sky. It is moving so fast. I'm used to things in international sphere take a decade or two decades or three to go anywhere. Ecocide is happening really quickly. There's a wave of legislation is happening. The European Parliament has adopted something telling all the European Union member states to go pass ecocide laws. Belgium's done something, France has done something, other countries like in Latin America, like Brazil, they're doing something. So it's moving at lightning speed. It's happening. It's not just a vision or a dream or an aspiration. It's coming.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned that. I actually had to update the script because as I was writing it, the Belgium law came out.
Right.
So it's definitely evolving very quickly.
Yeah. Yeah, too hard to stay on top of.
Yeah. And finally, do you foresee Canada adopting ecocide or a similar crime into the criminal code in the near future? And why or why not?
You know, I hope that Canada will one day be joining this wave. At this moment, Canada is not really part of the wave. Canada has not done a lot on the international front or on the domestic front. I think their position is something like Canada follows this matter with interest, which is kind of a bystander thing to say. So I think Canada probably is going to need the comfort of seeing other countries do stuff. And then there's going to need to be a public push, which will then lead to a political push. And I do think Canada is going to join the club, but we'll have to nudge them.
Yeah, I agree with that. Canada likes to do things last, I've noticed.
Yeah, a little bit. It used to be Canada used to be more of a leader, but we've become a little bit cautious.
Awesome. Well, that's all my questions. Was there anything else you want to add?
No, that was great.
Thank you, Professor, for chatting with me today and sharing your insights on this fascinating topic. The future of legal environmental protection in Canada is in the midst of huge changes, and I'm sure we're all excited to see what happens next. Attitudes around the world seem to be changing from viewing nature as a resource to exploit into a symbiotic, coexisting entity of its own that we share this planet with. Whether you view natural entities like this or not, the fact remains. We depend on these environmental structures to survive. Harming them will inevitably harm us. However it happens, hopefully Canadian and international legal systems can quickly come to a consensus on the importance of legally protecting natural structures before they're destroyed. Just one final reminder before we sign off for the day, this podcast does not contain legal advice. Pro Bono Students Canada is a student organization. This podcast was prepared with the assistance of PBSC Queen's Law student volunteers. PBSC students are not lawyers, and they are not authorized to provide legal advice. The podcast contains a general discussion of certain legal and related issues only. If you require legal advice, please consult a lawyer. Once again, I am your host, Maeve McNaughton, and thank you so much for listening to this week's episode of Pro Bono Radio here at the Queen's University Faculty of Law.